Okay, so our class has been on Ezra now these last 3 weeks, but as you can see, I've got it kind of subtitled there, parenthetical, with number one class on Zechariah. Not sure at this point how many classes we're going to be having on Zechariah itself, but just to recognize that Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, who are three, you know, contiguous books in your Old Testament there, they're all lined up together, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And then Haggai and Zechariah, who are also next to each other in the minor prophets. Now, those five books are all in essentially the same time frame. Nehemiah stands apart, you know, and about 100 years, in fact, from the earliest. But he really belongs with them because it's all about rebuilding Jerusalem and particularly the temple after the 70 years captivity in Babylon. So what I've chosen to do this time around, and I haven't done that this way in the past, but this time, since Ezra comes first chronologically, but is also a very divided book, the first six chapters of Ezra and then chapter 7 and following have a very significant gap of time in the middle, which we'll be talking about in the next couple of slides. But that is where Haggai and Zechariah fit. They're in the first part of Ezra, contemporary with the individuals that are featured in the first six chapters of Ezra. Ezra himself, who apparently wrote the book, is not featured in the first six chapters, though. He shows up the second time. So what we've got going on, and we'll have a look at this on the chart that I've shown you before here. Please recognize, I'm asking anybody to try to memorize this and hope you see enough of it. But the upper line here are these kings of Persia, Cyrus and Darius. And in 539 B.C., we have the fall of Babylon, and therefore all of these Jews that had been taken captive by Babylon in 606, 597, and 586, these people who've come into the Persian Empire, into the Babylonian Empire in three waves, are now, since the Persians have conquered the Babylonians, being told they can go home. They will, coincidentally, go home in three waves as well. So the first six chapters of Ezra speak of the first return. The last chapters speak of the second return. Nehemiah is going to be dealing with a third return. So we're going to see similar coming home as we did being taken off into exile. In some respects, the returns and the rebuilding of the city and the temple will perfectly parallel each other with our 70-year time frame. From 606 B.C., 7 years later would be what year? I love doing the math problems. 606 to 536. There's a 70-year period from the first of the captivity to the laying of the foundation for the temple. So you're going to have exactly a 70-year period there. And 70 years exactly from the first of the exile, when they went into Babylon, to the first return as they come back into Jerusalem. Then the third invasion by Nebuchadnezzar took place in what year? This is the most important one. What year is it for the third of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian invasions? 586. What makes that one so important? This is when the temple is completely destroyed. Solomon's temple, which has stood for over 400 years in what must have been shocking glory and majesty, just an amazing structure, in any time, and particularly in such ancient times, has been completely destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Everything of value has been taken into his storehouses and treasuries. But in 536, exactly 70 years after the first invasion, we have this first return in 586 plus 70 years. So from the destruction of the temple in 586 to its rededication, we have exactly 70 years. What year is that? 516 then. So you have two 70-year periods. One has to do with the first invasion to the first return. The other has to do with the temple's destruction to the temple being rededicated again. And so on the chart, you can see here's Ezra chapters 1 through 6. It says 538 to 516 is what it's covering. Then you have Zechariah and Haggai right here that are inserted into our chronology. Then you have the book of Esther. And then you've got only 1 year that's going to be dealt with in Ezra chapters 7 through 10. We'll come to in good time. Nehemiah is going to be down here from 445 to 415. The last remaining prophet of the Old Testament will be Malachi, also about 400 B.C. So we're looking at the last of not just the chronology of written information in the Old Testament, but the last of these prophets as well. So we talked about all that last time. What I'm going to do now, and you'd be able to follow, if you like, in the book of Ezra. We look at several passages in Ezra. I'm going to be giving you dates, and so you might want to be looking in Ezra, though I am going to put the verses up on the screen, so we'll have them here. But you might want to be writing these dates into the margins of the book of Ezra, since we finished the first six chapters last week. In Ezra chapter 4, and in verse 24, it says that work on the house of God in Jerusalem ceased, and it stopped until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Ezra 4:24 is 520 B.C. 520 B.C. is the second year. Now there's 12 months, and so in this case I don't have months for you, but it's in that immediate vicinity. The work stops in 520 B.C. In chapter 5, in verse 1, just immediately after that, and in verse 2, Ezra 5, 1 and 2, when the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, then Zerubbabel and Jeshua arose and began to rebuild the house of God which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So by the time you get to Ezra chapter 5, these two men are being named. I edited this a little bit and didn't tell you who their fathers were. But these two men, Haggai and Zechariah, are going to instigate the resumption of the temple's construction. In the end, it's going to take a total of 20 years for them to rebuild this temple. And God's real unhappy about it. So these two prophets, both of them, are sent by God to get these people up and running again. Then, in chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, still in Ezra, and the last chapter, sixth chapter, that's this first block in Ezra, says in chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, the elders of the Jews were successful in building through the prophesying of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. Now again, I'm leaving their parentage out. But these two men, they are given total credit, exclusive credit, for getting this temple built. They were successful through the prophesying of those prophets. Had they not come, apparently this temple would have had its foundation and nothing else, just in perpetuity. They weren't going to finish it. So Haggai and Zechariah, they get the people stimulated. The rest of this passage says they finished building according to the command of the God of Israel and the decree of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. This temple was completed on the third day of the month Adar. It was the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. So that would be 516 B.C. And you can see three kings are named. They began with one king and laid a foundation. Then they got threatened and maybe they got a little selfish and perhaps even lazy. I'm not sure what. But they didn't build, you know, for a long period of time. Then come Haggai and Zechariah. They motivate them to get going again. It's going to take another 4 years before they actually get it finished, though. And so we've got a total of three of these Persian kings that will be involved, because the last one is going to be getting a letter, you know, hey, what are these people doing? Is there something in the archives that would allow them to do this? And he'll do the research and writes back, says, sure enough, I have found, you know, records that say they've got every right to be doing this, so leave it alone and pay for it too, as we saw last week. So we've spanned now the first six chapters of Ezra from 536 all the way down to 5:16. There's a 20-year span in the first six chapters of Ezra. Then, last week, though again, for those of you that weren't here, I read, without much comment at all, the first two chapters, which are the only two chapters of Haggai. Tiny, tiny little bit. Well named as a minor prophet then, because this very artificial designation that we use between major and minor prophets is built only on what? The size of the book. And it's not all that accurate, as we'll see in a minute, but in this case, really is. If size gives you the designation minor prophet, then Haggai is well qualified. His book begins, two little chapters, with the first verse, in the second year, which is the same year we just saw in Ezra. In the second year of Darius the king, same king we just read about in Ezra. On the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai and to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the high priest, saying, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, this people says the time has not come, even the time for the house of the Lord to be rebuilt." So the first thing out of Haggai's mouth is, these people say it's not the right time to be rebuilding the temple. What will the Lord's response, and therefore Haggai's response, be to this proposition that it's not the time to be building the Lord's house? Yes, it is. You are wrong. Get busy. Yes, Bill.
Reading in 6:14, I just had a question. Why is the third king Artaxerxes even listed if that was after the temple was finished?
Well, you remember from last week, they had been building, laid, you know, empty. Haggai and Zechariah get them going again, and then the inquiry comes to Artaxerxes of whether or not they have a right to finish it off. And then we're told in the last chapter that he writes back and says, yes, you can. So it's just, you know, it's 20 years, and so it spans a total of three Persian kings. Right? Okay. So here we are in Haggai in the second year of Darius the king. And as we saw in Ezra, and again we're seeing in Haggai, these are the two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, that correct these people when they say that the time has not come. Now, with this one, I chose to get even a little more specific, and you'll see why as we go on the next few verses here. But next to Haggai chapter 1 and verse 1, you can see he's specific. It is the first day of the sixth month, so it's what we would call our September or October of 520 B.C. The calendars don't match well at all. It's always frustrating when you're thinking, how do you translate Jewish time into our time? So we've got very different conventions. February's only got 28 or 29 days, and we got some with 30 and some with 31, and then we got a leap year. You know, we're doing all our stuff. They had their calendar kind of shifted already by about 2 weeks. And so when it says the first day of the sixth month, it would be in the middle of September for their first day of the sixth month. And it'll end that month in the middle of our October. So you'll see a lot of these dates like the one I've just done. They put September/October of 520. But still, again, it's that second year Darius is 520 B.C. You will have noticed from our reading last week in Haggai chapter 1 again, but at verses 14 and 15, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and worked on the house of the Lord of hosts, their God, on the 24th day of the sixth month, in the second year of Darius the king. So now we're looking at October/November of 520 B.C. It's, just a little bit later that second body of information from Haggai is delivered. Then see what happens in chapter 2, on verse 1 and 2, on the 21st of the 7th month, so we go from the 6th month to just the next month, the word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet, saying, "Speak now to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, son of Jozadak, high priest,
to the remnant of the people, saying, who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory? How do you see it now? Does it not seem to you like nothing in comparison? But now, take courage, Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Take courage also, Joshua, son of Jehozadak, high priest. All you people of the land, take courage, declares the Lord of work, for I'm with you, declares the Lord of hosts. So as Bill was just pointing out, we've got these three kings, and then the second one had shut down the work. The third one is going to resume the work. And in between, with twice the statement about taking courage, we are informed. The people were frightened. They lost their legal right to build. And so, initially, they were shut down. But they let themselves be shut down for a decade and a half. And that has to stop. So Haggai and Zechariah come to do it. But this is September/October now of 520 B.C. because it's the next month. It's the seventh month. So if you're taking the notes again, September, October, 520. Then comes Haggai 2:10 and 11. On the 24th of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to Haggai the prophet, saying, thus says the Lord of hosts. And this is December of 520 to January of 519. We've got to go downhill because it's B.C. But you can see how tightly packed these writers are. Ezra, Haggai, and Zechariah are specifically dating their prophecies. And they are dating those prophecies, in some cases, within just months of each other. And then in the end, we'll see a total of 4 years. So, this information we saw last week. Haggai is a tiny little book. Tonight, we're going to start, and certainly not finish, then the second of those two prophets. So we're going to be looking at Zechariah for the next probably couple of weeks. And we're going to be doing that because, well, first I should just state, there are 27 different Zechariahs in the Old Testament. So we know very little about this particular man, even as we know virtually nothing about any of the others. It's just a really common name. So you have to be careful, because there'll be a Zechariah in the New Testament. There'll also be a Zacharias in the New Testament. Two different men, though similar. And, you know, it just gets frustrating because we're tempted to think, you know, we're talking about the same men. We're not. They're spanning all kinds of long periods of time, Old Testament to New Testament. We know really nothing about this man, except he was successful in the mission that God sent. 27 of them in the Old Testament themselves. This is the largest of the minor prophet books. How many chapters does Zechariah have? 14. Daniel is called a major prophet. And it's a smaller book. It's a little frustrating that way. Jeremiah wrote Lamentations. Lamentations only got 4 chapters. But because Jeremiah wrote it, it gets lumped in with which group? Minor or major? It gets called major, even though it's a third or a quarter of the size of Zechariah's book. Zechariah really should have been called a major prophet if we're going to get serious about the size of the books. It really is kind of a mystery why he'd be called minor in the first place. Well, he's a lot smaller than Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, but he's bigger than Daniel. And it's not just a big book. It is tougher than a boot, my dad used to say. In all the Old Testament, it's pretty common agreement. When you think of books, this is the toughest book in the Old Testament. Zechariah is just mystifying. Very difficult book to specifically or very minutely or precisely be able to interpret. And this is because it is what is loosely referred to as apocalyptic literature. Now, first test of the night. But, you know, apocalypse. In English, when we use the word apocalypse, what do we mean?
End of the world.
Say again?
End of the world.
Yes, we think in terms of the end of the world, and so the term has come to mean anything that is an apocalypse is of gargantuan, horrific, murderous, and destructive, you know, size, and is just overwhelmingly awful. So an apocalyptic event, you'll hear it described of volcanoes, you know, when thousands of people die. A tsunami is called an apocalyptic event. People are always fearing the apocalypse because in our culture and times, the way the word is used, it has to do with something being just shockingly destructive. A lot of people are going to die, and preeminently it means the end of the whole world, where everybody is going to perish. There will be a world no more. In Greek, what's the word actually mean? Revelation is the apocalypse. Totally different idea now. In the actual word, it's been terribly misunderstood, abused, and misused in our culture. We've just described the way the word gets used in our culture today. It's totally wrong, but you know that's the way we use it. How's it used in the New Testament in its Greek form, which brought the word into our language? What is apocalypse translated? Revelation. That's what the word means. It means unveiling, uncovering. It means to take something from obscurity that's difficult to understand and make it plain. The first word in the book of Revelation is this word. But because Revelation has been so badly misunderstood over 2,000 years to be talking about the end of the world, then they lifted this first word, which means revelation, and then they said, see, this book that starts with that word is about the end of the world, so we're going to haul this Greek word into English. Apocalypsis becomes apocalypse or apocalyptic. A brand new word is born in English, and then we assign the definition, you know, end of days, end of the world, or end of a city or a culture or whatever, you know, is an apocalypse. It's none of that. It means revealing. Now, there's a third definition, which is the one I'm trying to get to, when we say apocalyptic literature. Bible books are also grouped by this third and again different term, apocalyptic literature. And this time, it doesn't necessarily mean end of the world. It also does not mean revelation. It means full of astonishing imagery that we would call symbolic or figurative, but also kind of unhinged from the real world. So apocalyptic literature is those Bible books, Revelation in the New Testament, and here Zechariah in the Old being the two most prominent, in which people see visions that describe things you do understand being combined together into a thing that has never existed. And then this monstrosity that is a combination of a bunch of things then represents something else. So we just finished Daniel not too long ago. What was happening in Daniel? We have a shaggy goat and a ram, and they're clashing, and huge horn, and then we've got beasts, and then, you know, it looks like a lion, but it's got wings, and then it stands up like a man, and so there's parts. You know what a wing is, you know what a lion is, you know what a man is, but we put these things together in what is now called apocalyptic literature. So it's just frustrating in our culture now that God's Greek word that starts the book of Revelation and means a revealing became a catastrophe in one context in the English, or a mystifying book full of symbols and figures in another context. So it's kind of, this is a, a pretty all-purpose word. It's what it's become. So you just have to struggle with it. But you're going to find people saying, you know, Zechariah then is the chief of the Old Testament apocalyptic literature. And it will drive you just, you know, nuts to distraction trying to figure out how much of a given statement am I supposed to interpret. Moment, we're going to see some horses. Each horse is going to have a different color. Why the different colors? And does God tell us? No. So, as you know, in the religious world, save for churches of Christ, but in the religious world in general, as soon as you see a figurative expression, a symbolic presentation, an apocalyptic vision that does not have an individual part explained, what does the religious world do? Immediately, with great confidence, says, this means that. And it will be utterly detached from anything else in Scripture. It will be totally pulled out of their heads. And then with great confidence and authority, they'll tell you this is what it means. But God doesn't give an interpretation, for instance, on the colors of the horses. So we're about to go down into a vision, which, like parts of Daniel, which was apocalyptic literature, Zechariah is just going to be constant with these kinds of visions. There will be a lot of detail which I will not be able to explain, just like the colors of those horses. I'm also not going to be speculating about it. Red is the color of war because of blood, and so the first horse represents warfare. White always is associated with purity, and so this has to do with righteousness. Are those statements verifiable anywhere in Zechariah? No. Might, for instance, white robes in Revelation, and these are the righteous deeds of the saints, have an interpretation in Revelation that assigns this idea of purity to whiteness? And it's easy to see. It's purity. That's why we wash our clothes. We want the t-shirts to come out, you know, white as possible. So we see these connections. When they're explained, then we know how that's being used. But you got to be awful careful when they're not. So I don't know anything about righteous horses. When we've got a white horse, I don't know that I can assign that sort of an explanation. So, what we're going to do now is start the book of Zechariah, which itself starts by that very precise dating we just saw between verses 9 and 10 in Haggai chapter 2. Now, they're adjoining books, so everybody look first at Haggai. And in Haggai chapter 2, at verse 9, it says, "The latter glory of this house will be greater than the former, says the Lord of hosts, and in this place I shall give peace, declares the Lord of hosts." End of the prophecy, which started in chapter 2, verse 1, in October, November of 520 B.C. In verse 10, now it's the 24th of the 9th month. The first 9 verses are on the 21st of the 7th month. In between the 21st of the 7th month and the 24th of the 9th month, both of those in the second year of Darius, turn the page to Zechariah 1:1. In between these two, we have, obviously, the 8th month. The 8th month of the second year of Darius. We've been told by Ezra, these two prophets were sent by God to motivate the people to do the work. Haggai, we read last week, he motivated people to do the work. They say, it's not the time to build the temple. He says, you bet it is. Now get up and grab a hammer. So they did. Zechariah, likewise, was sent, and we've been told, you saw the passages earlier, he was sent for the purpose of moving those people to finish work on that temple. But he will accomplish his work in a strikingly different manner than Haggai will. Haggai's simple. Haggai's easy. Haggai's just telling them what for. Zechariah is apocalyptic. So I'm going to leave you, you know, with one last slide here as we think about starting Zechariah itself, with just two things as a general rule in Zechariah's book. On the title page of Zechariah's book, you can write these two things. Number one, his mission is to get those people to build that temple and Jerusalem itself. Get busy. You've been lying idle and building your own houses, as Haggai said. But what makes Zechariah very different and interesting is that his book is amazingly messianic. Very clearly, while he is a man of his time who has physical deeds that he is saying have to be done, while he is very much a man of his times for the work that has to be done in our times, he spends an enormous amount of these 14 chapters telling us about the coming of Jesus the Christ. Some very helpful material, as a matter of fact, and particularly chapters 12 and 13 and 14, the last three. But in this amazing imagery, which will be pushing these people to physically get to work in the material world, he is also going to be using astonishing visions that we can tell very clearly are about events that are 500 years away. Events that can only be fulfilled in a new kind of a king. A king who will not rule over just Jerusalem, but what? The whole world. A spiritual king over a spiritual kingdom. So this book has these two things in mind. And especially with this second one. Only Isaiah, that we studied at such length, 66 chapters, can rival Zechariah for messianic information. These people are being taught, build with your hands and your tools a physical temple. What do we know about temples today, thanks to the New Testament? Do we need a physical temple? No. Is there a physical temple? No. The one that they built and that was remodeled several times over the next several hundred years and finally will be ultimately destroyed in 70 AD, will there be a third temple? Is that one going to be rebuilt? No, it's not. So there's no temple today at all, right? There's a temple.
Aren't our bodies referred to as the temple of the Lord?
That's the answer. There's not a physical temple in the sense of a structure we build to go into. But as Bob's just pointed out, you betcha there's a temple. And the Old Testament material temple becomes representative of another house that God lives in. What house is that today?
Us.
That's us. Okay? So, once again, you have figures in the Old Testament that are representative of substantive realities, but of a spiritual nature in the New Testament. Get that temple built. It is a part of God's message to mankind about His dwelling places. So they get up, they build the physical one. Later, we are the spiritual temple of the living God. They have physical kings. What do we have? We have a heavenly king, a spiritual king, the Lord Jesus Christ. So the parallels will be obvious. So here we go. Zechariah 1:1. In the eighth month of the same second year of Darius, we saw in Haggai and Ezra, the word of the Lord came to Zechariah the prophet, son of Berechiah, son of Iddo, saying, "The Lord was very angry with your fathers. Therefore say to them, thus says Yahweh," all capital L-O-R-D, all capital letters spelled Lord in most Bibles, references the word sometimes translated Jehovah. I use Yahweh, but it is the personal name of the only true and living God. So Yahweh in verse 2 was angry with the fathers. In verse 3, thus says Yahweh of hosts, return to me, declares Yahweh of hosts, that I may what? Return to you. You have to come to me if I'm going to come to you. You have to do your part for me to choose to do my part. We're going to work together or we're not going to work at all. We have a conditional relationship. You meet the conditions, then you will receive the benefits. But if you don't, you will not. Return to me, declares Yahweh of hosts, that I may return to you, says Yahweh of hosts. Verse 4. Do not be like your fathers, to whom the former prophets proclaimed, saying, thus says Yahweh of hosts, return now from your evil ways and from your evil deeds. But they did not listen or give heed to me, declares Yahweh. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? Do they? They die. Where were all these people's fathers? Dead in Babylon in the course of the last 70 years. Verse 6, but did not my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, overtake your fathers? Then they repented and said, as Yahweh of hosts purposed to do to us in accordance with our ways and our deeds, so he has dealt with us. So in these first six verses then, what does Zechariah say? Don't be like your fathers. When I sent them prophets, did they pay attention? No, they didn't. What happened because they didn't? Went into captivity, got destroyed, lost their homes, got killed. All right? Then, after all of that, they said, might be a good idea to serve the Lord. They figured out, you know, we ought to repent. And when they did, God's prophecies are fulfilled both ways. First, the captivities, then the freedom and the coming of home. So, in chapter 1 of verse 1, it's October/November of 520 B.C. October-November 520 B.C., the 8th month in between the 7th and the 9th in the last chapter of Haggai. These men were working together back home in Jerusalem with the people who have returned in the first wave under Zerubbabel in the first six chapters of Ezra. Now, in verse 7, we start reading again. This is now February or March of 519 B.C. Excuse me. My nose just messed tonight. So, verse 7. On the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month Shabbat, in the second year of Darius. That's the year, this 520, now 519, the way the calendars are shifted. The word of the Lord came to Zechariah the prophet, son of Berechiah, son of Iddo, as follows. Now, here we go. On Sunday night, if you were here, how many of you were here on Sunday night? A week ago. Not this last, but 2 weeks ago, I mean. 2 Sundays back. Okay. What did I do that night? We read the first 8 chapters of Zechariah without comment. I spent 25 minutes and just read Zechariah. So we've been through this. I wanted to, you know, get it past you twice, so you had a full reading of it once already. What did we find out is going to happen in Zechariah's first 6 chapters? 8 visions. 8, depending on how you use the term, apocalyptic revelations come to this man. So grab your pencils, grab your pens, get ready. I will give you the outline. Vision number 1 in Zechariah's book of these 8, which all take place one after the other in one single event. He's going to get 8 visions at one time. The first one is chapter 1, verses 8 through 17. So put vision number 1. 1, 8 through 17. And this one is the four horsemen Now, I got big margins, and so I put four horsemen among the myrtle trees. We'll get to that detail in a moment. But just write, chapter 1, verses 8 through 17 is vision number 1 of the 8, and it's the four horsemen. Now, as soon as I say four horsemen, what do you think? The four horsemen of the apocalypse. As a matter of fact, I'll show you in a minute. We don't even know for sure that there are four horsemen here. Now, it looks like it. We'll see how this works in a minute. I'll show you. There's kind of two ways to view this thing. But at any rate, you know, if it is four horsemen here, and we have four horsemen in Revelation, then it catches our attention, doesn't it? We immediately, you know, want to see then, are they somehow identical? If I can get pieces understood in Zechariah, maybe I should carry them into Revelation. If I get parts of it that are clarified for us by the Revelation, then maybe I can bring those ideas back into Zechariah. Is that a valid approach to Bible study? Yeah, yeah, certainly it is. But that does not mean that these two necessarily must be the same thing. In fact, I don't think they are. So we're going to always be, you know, comparing Bible passages, but they must always primarily be understood in their own context. We've got to be careful that we don't just assume, you know, they have to be the same just because we see similarities. That's not necessarily the case. So here we go in verse 8. What time of day is it? It's night. Behold, a man was riding on a red horse, and he was standing among the myrtle trees which were in the ravine, with red sorrel and white horses behind him. Now, everybody, look at our little problem that I just introduced. How many horses are there? Okay, most people say four. Now, I saw at night, behold, a man was doing what on a red horse? Okay, and he was what among the myrtle trees? Okay, now I have a picture of my mom standing on a horse. She's about 10 or 11 years old. She's been quite the horsewoman since she was very young. But I really don't think the guy was standing up in the saddle, do you?
No.
No. Is he necessarily on the horse while he's standing among the myrtle trees? Could not Zechariah have seen a man riding on a red horse who then did what? Dismounted, and now he's standing among the myrtle trees with a red horse, a sorrel horse, and a white horse behind him. In which case, the red horse would be the same horse that he rode in on, which now that he's dismounted is with the other two horses behind him among the myrtle trees. I don't know how to tell you which it is. Maybe there are two red horses. Okay. Maybe there's only one. But isn't it funny how you all deal with just such confidence? You all say, there are four horses. Well, I know. But if you read carefully, I'm not sure there is. Does it matter? I think not. It doesn't seem to make any difference in the interpretation that we're about to get. So what I did was I went and got some pictures of horses. As you know, I've been involved with horses all my life, or at least my mom and dad were. Here would be a red horse. Here is a sorrel horse. It's a color that you never hear of unless you have horses. You know, that is sorrel. And then there was a white horse. Now everybody take a close look. That's my mom's horse. Okay, that is Dreamazon. It's one of the more famous Arabians ever in, you know, in the United States and in history. When you see these pluses, that's a designation that they do in the Arabian purebred horse world, and that's the highest ranking you can get. So Dreamazon was sold to the lady that owned the Chicago Tribune, you know, and still lives. As a matter of fact, of course, been around a long time now. My mom hasn't seen it in years, but eventually it wound up, you know, with the lady that owns the Chicago Tribune. It's a pretty horse, isn't it?
It really is. And I don't know if it's as pretty as the one in the vision. You have to ask Zechariah when you get a chance to see him. You know, but you know what? Maybe there were two red horses. But these are the colors of the horses. So then it says, in verse 8 again, it's night. A man was riding on a red horse, and he was standing among the myrtle trees, which were in the ravine, with red sorrel and white horses behind him. Now, commentators can go crazy why it's a ravine instead of a plain, instead of a mountain. You know, and brethren, is there any other information given? No. I don't know why it was a ravine. I don't know what the colors mean. I don't know what the number of horses means, and I can't even figure out how many horses there are. But this much I think I can figure out. In verse 9, I said, "My Lord, what are these?" The angel who was speaking with me said to me, "I will show you what these are." And the man who was standing among the myrtle trees answered and said, "These are those whom the Lord has sent to patrol the earth." So they answered the angel of the Lord who was standing among the myrtle trees and said, now by the way, who's standing among the myrtle trees now? It's an angel of the Lord that's now standing. So apparently the one that rode, seems to me, has now dismounted, is standing over there in the myrtle trees, also speaking, and now it's called the angel of the Lord. He's standing there and says, "We have patrolled the earth, and behold, all the earth is peaceful and quiet." Then the angel of the Lord answered and said, "O Lord of hosts, how long will you have no compassion for Jerusalem and the cities of Judah, with which you have been indignant these?" How long? 70 years. And the Lord answered the angel who was speaking with me with gracious words, comforting words. So the angel who was speaking with me said to me, "Proclaim." So now Zechariah's job description is in verse 14. "Proclaim, thus says Yahweh of hosts, I am exceedingly jealous for Jerusalem and Zion," which is the hill that Jerusalem sits on, "but I'm very angry with the nations who are at ease. For while I was only a little angry, they furthered the disaster. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, I will return to Jerusalem with compassion. My house will be built in it, declares the Lord of hosts, and a measuring line will be stretched over Jerusalem. Again proclaim, saying, thus says Yahweh of hosts, my cities will again overflow with prosperity, and Yahweh will again comfort Zion and again choose Jerusalem." What do the unknown number of horses and riders represent? They are those who patrol the earth. So they went out and they apparently went everywhere. When they got done, what did they conclude? Peaceful. It's all peaceful and quiet. Great.
Do they patrol the earth or the land?
It said earth, didn't it? Oh, I see what you mean. You mean the planet, the entire planet, as opposed to the land of Israel, for instance. That's another question I just can't answer. Whatever the extent of their responsibility was, you know, they've done it. My sense is that it's probably not the whole planet, because all of this is rooted in the physical circumstances of the Jews. How many years were just named? You know, 70 years. What is that all about? Jeremiah prophesied that. Daniel read it and saw that it was about to come to an end. You know, that's exactly the number of years that the Babylonian captivity began, and the first wave then came back. 70 years from the destruction of the temple to the rebuilding and rededication. You know, so my sense is that it has to do with Israel, that earth. If it is to be extended throughout the whole Persian Empire, then I'm fine with that too. By the way, I forgot to show you what a myrtle tree looks like. Scraggly, scrawny thing it is. This one's actually in Israel. But you can imagine a thicket down in a ravine and the horses standing among them. It's not a big thing at all. You know, it's we think of it almost as just a bush, but no, it's a tree. But at any rate, you know, the circumstances are rooted all in Jerusalem. So, great question. Not sure, again, I can answer it. But what we know is, the end of verse 11, they did a job. The job was to report what they saw. And what they saw is that all the earth is two things: peaceful and quiet. Then the angel tells us God has compassion in verse 12 on Jerusalem. He's been indignant for 70 years, you know, so we're asking about that. The angel speaks in 13 with gracious words, comforting words. God in verse 14 is jealous for Jerusalem and Zion. That means he really loves it. He doesn't want it to be unfaithful. He doesn't want anybody else to try to lure Jerusalem and Judah or Zion away. I was angry with the nations who are at ease in 15. For a while, I was only a little angry, but they furthered the disaster. So, did Babylon consciously decide to obey some prophet that had been sent to Nebuchadnezzar to tell him what to do? Well, no. When they went and did this attack in 606 and 597, third time in 586, they did it for purely what kind of reasons? Selfish, personal reasons. They didn't think that they were doing anything for God, and Isaiah tells us so in chapter 13 of his book. We studied that some months ago. And so when God saw that he himself, God, describes himself as only a little angry, but what did these other Gentile nations do? They furthered the disaster. So now, the Jews get hauled into captivity. Many of them die. They spend 70 years in captivity. But the time has come after these people patrol the earth. It's all peaceful and quiet. So what kind of words is God speaking now at the end of the 70 years? Comforting. Gracious. I'm jealous for Jerusalem and Zion. And then comes this marvelous declaration now in verse 16. I will return with compassion. My house will be built. A measuring line will be stretched over it. In other words, it'll be exactly the way it's supposed to be, like carpenter uses his measuring line, make sure everything's where it belongs. And in 17, my cities will again overflow with prosperity, and the Lord will again comfort Zion and again choose Jerusalem. So, you say, well, what does sorrel mean? I don't know. What's the myrtle tree, you know, instead of a terebinth? I don't know. Well, how many horses? Oh, I don't know. But what's the point of the vision? It's okay. It's okay. Everything's peaceful and quiet. It's exactly the way it's supposed to be. It's time then for you guys to do what? What was Zechariah's overall mission? Get busy building. Everything's peaceful and quiet. You got no excuses. There isn't anything else to distract you. There's no wars, anything going on. Okay? And what else? They had all the money given to them. They had verified, you know, that they had a building permit. Get going. Take care of business. Now, big decision to think here. Okay, we're going to go for it. I think I can do it in 4 minutes. Vision number two. Vision number two. Chapter one. Verses 18 through 21. It's only four verses, so we'll do it in 4 minutes. These are the four horns and the four craftsmen. The four horns and the four craftsmen. So verses 18 through 21. I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, four horns. One vision after the other, eight of them in a row, no break. I lifted up my eyes from the four or three multicolored, different colored horses, and this comforting prophecy, it's all going to be rebuilt. I get this now, verse 19. I said to the angel who was speaking with me, what are these? These what? From the preceding verse, these horns. And he answered me, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Now, you can see up on the screen, here's just a typical thing you'll find on the internet. It says the four horns versus the four craftsmen. And in this case, they show the horns of a
bull or similar animal. And then with the craftsmen, what do they got? You know, wood planers. Dean would appreciate this. You know, wood planers. Okay. Just know that we often make these mistakes, and more recently, especially with Nazareth and Jesus' father, when we think about carpenters and craftsmen, and then go back to those days. You know, these are wood tools. And even with Joseph and Jesus in his early life, the word that's used there is not necessarily limited to wood. Craftsman is a better way to translate this. And they may have been stonemasons. And that's really important. You could use this kind of carpenter's tool on that kind of a horn, I suppose. But I'd like for you to look closely at this structure, and you can see the little girl just right behind. This structure is very proportionate so that a standard-sized adult can lay its sacrifice on top there to be burned. This is a Canaanite altar that was discovered here at Beersheba. Beersheba is the way you see it often pronounced or written in your Bible. I visited this place several times. Those who went with me this last time were there. And this is not the actual one that was found, but is a perfect replica on site. The original's in the Israel Museum, so I've seen that too. You can go see it. But this is an altar with four what? Horns on it. And it is the replica of the actual one they found. Those are horns. Do they look anything like this? And no. And what are they made out of? You know, stone. So the craftsman would be a stonemason, more likely. This is very frustrating, horns, because a horn could be on an animal, a horn could be on an altar, and both the Jews and the Gentiles made them like this. What other kind of horn is there? You can have the shofar, which is a ram's horn, and that could be a long, curlicue thing, be very different than the other. So I don't know what kind of horn it was. But it's, you know, we are told, what are they? In 19, he said, the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. So of the three, what horn would you think about if you're going to scatter people? You wouldn't think about, you know, the horn of oxen, bulls. But whatever it is, the Lord showed me four craftsmen in verse 20, and I said, what are these coming to do? And he said, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, so another reference to what we just saw, so that no man lifts up his head. But these have come, the craftsmen, to terrify them, to throw down the horns of the nations who have lifted up their horns against the land of Judah in order to scatter it. So, end prophecy. What's it about? All the land is peaceful and quiet. Build. And then comes prophecy number two. And what does it say? Everybody that scattered Israel. What nation did that? Israel, the 10 northern tribes. What nation did it? Assyria. What year? 722. And then Judah and Jerusalem. What nation did that? Babylon. How many times? Three times. 606, 597, and 586. But right now, all the world is what? Peaceful and quiet. Because what did the craftsmen do? They took care of those horns, didn't they? Those guys are not going to be disturbing you anymore. And me either, because my time is up.